across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan
Show! The Education Minister, Paul Given, in the Nolan Studio today, describing what he says is a first for the UK in terms of legislation he's proposing around school uniform policy. He's challenged over Liz Neill. We promise to continue our coverage on that story, which we've done today as well. And then the story of little Alfie. My goodness, a 12-year-old boy who has a tough life, a really tough life, and he's looking for a medicine in Northern Ireland which will help prolong how long he stays out of a wheelchair, as the disease, muscular dystrophy, Duchenne muscular dystrophy, attacks his body. It's a horrible disease, and Alfie's looking the best chance he can get, and he can't get the drug he wants in Northern Ireland. All coming up on the Nolan Show this morning. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. So, in its first in the UK, Northern Ireland could be getting legislation which will cap the cost of school uniforms, or at least legislation in place that could cap the cost of school uniforms. What's this all about? Well, you know there's been a row for many, many years over some children being excluded from being able to feel part of a school, from being able to feel part of a team with all of this branded gear that schools have been insisting on. And we've been covering this for, 20 years? Here in Northern Ireland. The Education Minister, Paul Given, is in the studio this morning. And are you going to be the Education Minister to finally do something about it, Paul?
I will be. When I took up office, this was one of the first issues that I know you questioned me about, but other people had brought to me during the election campaign. It was a manifesto commitment that the DUP made, that we would introduce legislation to help address the costs of school uniform. And there's a number of mechanisms that we're seeking to take forward that will help do that, because ultimately what we are trying to achieve is affordability when it comes to school uniforms, PE kits. It's a difficult time of year every year whenever it comes to school uniform. I remember in my household, I'm one of five kids. We used to save up the tax stamp. We would have collected that, and it would all have been used at around August time. It was a financial burden in our household when it came to it, and it continues to be a financial strain on families when it comes to school uniforms. And I don't want any child to be put off going to any particular school, because affordability is a question that some parents would have.
So you're going to put legislation in front of the Assembly today. I'll ask you about that imminently, what it will be. But what does it say about, and you're going to be reluctant to get into this, but what does it say about some school governors, some schools in Northern Ireland, that you're having to mandate them to make school uniforms as affordable in their schools? What does it say about that?
Well, the majority of schools do follow the guidance that has been in place, but that is advisory. It doesn't have legal force behind it. So the majority of schools do follow the guidance on all of this, but there are still examples where we believe there are concerns around affordability to do with school uniform, some of the detailed pleating that goes into even just a skirt and different embroidery that is required, and that all adds to the cost. And then the multiple numbers of PE kits, if you're involved in sport, in various sports, you all need to get different kits, and that came through strongly in the consultation. So what we're trying to do is to make sure that all schools follow the guidance that's in place. To do that, we have to give it statutory underpinning. And so the legislation that will be introduced today in the Assembly starts that process of giving legal effect to the guidance. And we're updating that guidance, but it will have legal force, and it will also be subject to the inspectorate going into schools when they carry out inspections to make sure that that guidance is being followed.
No offence, but some people listening to the Nolan Show today, and by the way, but for me doing this job, I'd probably be one of them. When you start talking about statutory guidance and legal underpinning, they have no baldy what you're talking about. So spell this out in layman's terms. What are you proposing to do for parents and forcing schools to adhere to?
Well, the guidance that we will now give legal force to, it's one thing to say this is what we would like you to do. It is another thing to say this is what you must do. And what schools will now be required under this legislation when it is passed, they must follow the guidance that is in place. And where schools don't follow that guidance, then it is open to the department to issue directions to say you have to do this if you haven't been doing it.
To an individual school?
To an individual school. So this will give legal force to that. But you know, boards of governors, and I was a board of governor for nearly 20 years in schools. Overwhelmingly, boards of governors, leadership teams in schools want to do the right thing. And you know, I'm there to support them. I am so grateful of the work that they do. But we need to make sure that when it comes to these decisions, that they're given the proper focus around the policies that they develop to do with school uniform. That includes consulting with parents, engaging with the pupils. It'll include providing information as to how you've carried out that process around the number of suppliers that are involved so that people can see the visibility as to who is it that is supplying your school. We want to make sure that there's an open market competition for that so that other suppliers that maybe have been excluded from being able to provide school uniforms, that they will be able to compete.
I'll get into that. But I was reading your proposed legislation, and you say that you will provide scope for a cap to be introduced. So scope for a cap to be introduced doesn't mean a cap's going to be introduced. It's the ability to introduce a cap. Why have you not been more forceful about this? We will introduce a cap.
Well, I'm future-proofing the legislation by including the provision to apply a cap, and that cap could be related to putting a financial.
But why a provision to, rather than saying there will be a cap?
Well, it's how we affect the change, and the change that we want is affordability, to make sure that is the core of what we're doing. That can be achieved through the guidance being followed, because the provisions within the guidance should enable an affordability component to be the key aspect of this. But I'm also taking provision that if people come back and say, listen, we've put in statutory guidance, we've looked at England, who have statutory guidance, their outworkings of this has created some concern that the statutory guidance in England hasn't been as impactful as they would have liked. So I've said, right, well, we need to put in statutory guidance, but let's also take provision that as a backstop, if this doesn't work the way I believe that it will, we could then introduce a cap to say, you now have a financial limit. This is the maximum that your school uniform and PE kits can cost. Or the cap could also set a provision that says you can only have 15 items, 16 items that make up the limit of your school uniform and your PE kits. That could all help. So I didn't want to come back in 12 months to say, Minister, you really should have taken provision for a cap because we think you now need to apply it. I've looked ahead and said, let's put in place provision to apply a cap. But it is the first within the United Kingdom. A cap doesn't exist anywhere else. So there are legitimate questions as to how would it operate? How could we give effect to that? How can we monitor it, police it, and ensure that it works? And we need to make sure that we would get that right before we would introduce the detail around a cap. But I've taken the prudent approach to say, let's take the powers to implement it, but we need to make sure that if we're going to do that, we get it right.
Okay, so if the cap were in place, who would decide how much it is each year? Would it be the minister?
Well, that would be set by
you?
That would be set by the department and me. So we would engage in what that figure should be, whether it's financial or whether it's related to the number of uniforms or whether it's a combination of both. So that would require me and the department to take that decision. And then we set that limit in place. But some of the issues that have came out from the consultation process, and you know, we had over 7,500 people who engaged in this you know, over the past number of months, one of the highest response rates that we had, which demonstrates why it's important to people. And as part of that, whenever we looked at the cap, questions were being asked by, you know, the UK Markets Competition. How would this work? Will it actually have the effect that you want? So that needs proper consideration before you would actually specify what it should be. But we shouldn't have to get to that, because if the guidance, which we now will put into law, is followed, then that will have the impact that we want it to have around the best place in terms of practice for school uniform.
Branded clothing is a big one within all of this, and parents being told, and at the end of the day, a school child being told, you're not a worthy part of this team unless you're wearing this branded gear. See that wee logo? That's the difference from you being able to be part of a team or not. What specifically, Minister, are you doing about branded clothing?
So we're saying that when it comes to branded clothing for PE kits, you know, there is a legitimate issue raised that if you're wearing a branded kit, is that necessary? Can you get the kit without it being branded? We highlight, for example, perhaps if a school is wanting to do this, should it only be those that are playing at representative level? Does every single child that is involved in, you know, my sport was football. You know, I did play for the school football team, but the vast majority of the kids didn't. So could you have that the football team, if it wants to, the school to have a branded kit for that purpose, do you then need to apply that to every single pupil? Because that can drive up the cost if we're going down that approach.
Is that not problematic? Because within that, okay, if you implemented that, you've got all of these other teams within that same school, and the principle of a brand does not exclude you. And then through your ability and hard work and training, you get onto the big team. And if you're from a working class housing estate, you can't get on ultimately to the big team because you're going to allow it to be branded at that stage.
Well, I wouldn't want any school to be selecting a child based on their ability to play for that school and then them not being able to do it to do with the cost of the uniform. So, you know, it's important that schools do have the opportunity to develop their own uniform policy. What I don't think we should do, and what I shouldn't do as minister, is to say, here is the prescription for every single school when it comes to your uniform. Because uniforms reflect the school, the ethos. It is right that people, as I went to my school, I was very proud of my school, the blazer, the emblem. And we should allow schools to be able to reflect that individualism. And we also need to allow boards of governors to develop these policies. But this approach will give a renewed focus on how schools go about developing their school uniform policy. And at its core is about making sure that it's affordable and that hardworking parents who struggle every year should not be precluded from going to any particular school to do with cost.
There looks to me to be some possible gaps in this. It says schools will have to consult with parents and pupils. What? And then do their own thing anyway? Sometimes consultations can mean absolutely nothing, as you know. So consulting them what?
But then they have to publish. So it isn't just consult and engage, and that's important that schools would do that. The guidance will also require that the school need to publish the rationale for the approach that they're taking. So,
and they'll say, as they've said before, do you know what? This branded gear, it's high quality, it'll last longer, so here's our decision. Go to that one shop and buy it.
Well, no, because the provisions that we're seeking to take is to make sure that there can be open competition within a town or a city where there are multiple suppliers. They should be able to compete and provide school uniforms. So exclusivity when it comes to those deals is something that I am saying we shouldn't be having. But we need to then make sure that there is transparency and we publish that information. So engage, consult, but then publish. And then that creates a degree of accountability. So then people can ask the question of the school leadership and challenge, if that's appropriate, why did you reach that decision? Here was your consultation, but here was your decision. And you question that. And I know from experience as a Board of Governor, when a parent comes and asks these questions, it's a serious issue. You look at it, you then question, and you seek to devise policy that is appropriate for your school.
But we have been in a situation for many years that parents have questioned this. By the way, some supporting it, some not. And branded gear has prevailed in these schools. Are you saying that what this legislation is doing is ultimately giving you the legal ability last, after you've gone through all the layers you've discussed, the legal ability to say to a school, actually, too much branded gear and you're not selling to just one shop?
So, yes, if at the outworkings of this, we find that a school is not following the guidance, which will then become the law, the department can issue a direction to that school to say, you're in breach of this guidance, here's what you need to do. And that is something that you can't do currently because it's advisory, the guidance. We're now moving the dial on this by putting it into legislation. And this is going to have a material impact for those people who are struggling.
One of the ways schools have been able to claim that they do not have exclusivity, Minister, because it's in the guidance at the minute. The guidance is not statutory guidance, but it's in the guidance at the minute, is they say, well, we don't have exclusivity because we've got this one supplier and we also sell it. Are you going to mandate that it's more than one external supplier needs to be able to sell that uniform?
Well, I think there'll always be a local context for this. We've over 1,000 schools across Northern Ireland, some in rural areas where there is only one retailer, and it's inevitable that that's who is going to be the provider. And I think in those circumstances, that would be entirely appropriate. What I don't think is appropriate is, you know, Belfast, huge number of retailers involved in the provision of, you know, supplying school uniforms, PE kits. You've got online, particularly on PE kits, you've got online providers when it comes to this. I just think that exclusivity is not something that is going to achieve the most effective when it comes to cost.
And the way some of my callers put it to me over the years, a pair of black trousers is a pair of black trousers. Will you be protecting parents that if they want to go to a supermarket and buy a pair of black trousers at 5, 6, 7, 8 quid from having to buy a pair of trousers at 30 quid?
Yes. So we will, like this, we'll be making clear that, you know, where a supermarket is able to provide the equivalent type of uniform, then they should be able to purchase from that supermarket. I also want to be very clear as well that our independent retailers do really good work on this. And I met them as part of this process and consultation, and they understandably, they do have concerns. What could this mean for their own business? And it's important that as we take this forward, that we keep in mind that for a lot of independent retailers and schools, supermarkets can't provide the uniform. It's those independent retailers do. They engage with the school as part of the process. They're purchasing well in advance. You know, they will have already prepared for this September. They'll have made their orders. And it's important that we keep that in mind when it comes to the process of the school uniforms, because independent retailers do very good work when it comes to this, and there's clear evidence they do provide value for money. So I want to make sure that we don't do anything that would be detrimental to independent retailers.
So finally, this is going in front of the Assembly today. When could this actually be effective from?
So depending when the legislation gets approved by the Assembly, that could be before the summer. We're certainly aiming to facilitate the Assembly processes to do that by the end of June, but that will be a matter ultimately for the Assembly to decide upon and the committee. But this would take effect in September 2026 because there's a lead-in time for this to give effect. As I indicated, retailers and schools already have their school uniform in place. Purchasing orders have been made. And, you know, that's for 1st of September this year. So this gets passed by September the following year. This legislation will be in place and the guidance would need to be followed.
And if schools are on kickbacks, that'll have to be published.
Yes. Yes, there has to be, you know, we need to be able to publish and see transparency around this, and that's important for people to have confidence in it.
Minister, you're making this announcement today after a fortnight where you have been the focus of accusations that you have a pet project, and that pet project is Liss Neill School in Foyle, the accusation that you awarded a 3G pitch to that school. And I note today that the Education Authority are fighting back over these allegations of sectarianism, and they're saying, in summary, they're saying, well, if everybody's talking about Liss Neill School, there were five other projects similar to Liss Neill in 2024-25 where the exact same criteria were used. Begs the question, why the focus on Lisneal. The politicians who were talking about Lisneal getting an IFA FIFA pitch, the Education Authority saying, well, that just refers to the size of the pitch and the post-primary school recommendation. The guidelines say all schools getting an upgrade will get post-primary will get this size of pitch. They're saying the £1 million threshold, there's been a lot around that because it was published at 500,000, has been in place since 2017. How come the Education Authority have let this story run for 2 weeks?
Well, like, I've had to get on with the job, and the school uniform announcement today is an example of me continuing to remain absolutely focused on this. But I accept that in the course of this role, there will be political knockabout. And some of the inferences and framing of this debate, I think, has been wholly inappropriate. But what has been particularly disturbing for me has been the deployment of one particular school to score political points against me. And I heard from the principal, I've spoken with the principal, and the impact that it has had on him. And I think that is deplorable. And I said last week an apology was owed. If they can't apologise to me, they should at least be apologising to the principal and the school for the way in which this debate has been framed, because our principals do incredible work. They should never be afraid to reach out to me as a Minister of Education to seek support for their school. But the facts around this has been inaccurately reported, and the way it has been used by other political opponents has been wrong, and they should be apologising for that.
Well, the question remains, why were EA sitting for the last couple of weeks saying nothing?
Well,
publicly, where have they been?
So EA did put out a statement.
Statement? Why are they not getting it right into the media and saying, here's the score?
Well, I can get to that. But whenever the article was published on a Friday by the Belfast Telegraph, framed in a way that suggested that because there was a meeting with two DUP ministers, that somehow that had provided this project to go forward. On the Saturday, EA put out a statement to say that the minister was not involved and had not applied any influence around the decision making, and yet that information was not carried. Political opponents on the Monday went into the Assembly and made further allegations.
Wow.
And so when information has been put out, it has been either ignored or I would be concerned at the way it has actually been used.
Well, you talk about the Belfast Telegraph framing something. If a school principal goes to a meeting where there are two DUP ministers and then a school is awarded a pitch and there is no application process funded by the school, that's a story all day long to investigate, Paul. It just is. When you suggest the Telegraph were framing something, they were looking at a story. But I then notice in how the EA have been laying some of the explanation finally out today, where they actually say in black and white that in terms of, and this is where the public interest is, how is a project prioritised? And they literally say, well, there is no scheme. There is no mechanism to prioritise a project. Like, how is that tenable?
So first of all, the EA today have put out, yesterday put out into the public domain, a detailed report around this project. They make it clear that the normal processes were followed for this project to be taken forward. There was an inspection carried out. This was all entirely within the normal processes. And the same processes that were followed for Lisneal were followed for other schools. And no one has raised any concerns about the process for other schools. And St Joseph's rightly got a new pitch in the same constituency, and they followed the same process. It was as a result of an inspection.
So there was no application by St Joseph's?
St Joseph's had made previous applications, but they were unsuccessful. They hadn't been successful. What was successful for St Joseph's was a pitch inspection that was carried out, and that was then taken forward, not on the back of a formal application process. So St Joseph's and Lisneal in the same constituency, with the same process, were able to have this pitch put in place. And yet I am concerned that those political opponents singled out one school in that constituency, with no reference to other schools which they had been actively campaigning for. And I commend Lisneal and St Joseph's and those schools for the approach that they have been taking.
You haven't addressed my question, though, as to whether we need to urgently look at a process currently in place where there's no criteria to prioritise projects. There's a finite amount of money. Lots of schools want something done. And there's no public transparent process as to even in created as to how something will be prioritised above another.
Well, there is, in that these were all deemed priority one schemes. The Northern Ireland Audit Office provided a useful definition of this, and it's in the EA report, that these schemes can range from £1,000 to £1,000,000 when it comes to minor works, but the breadth of what is involved in priority one schemes can go from providing disability access where a pupil needs to be able to navigate around a school, to boilers that break down that require urgent repair because the school has had to close, and if we don't fix it...
So how do you prioritise?
So all priority one, once you are deemed to be a priority one project, they are all taken forward.
Minister, but some are taken forward earlier than others.
Because the school boiler that breaks down, that the school has closed over, needs to be given that urgent repair and that work gets carried out. Other schemes won't be taken forward in the same time frame, but they are all caught within what are called priority one particular schemes. So the outworkings of this, because the inference was made that I had influenced the process. I did not influence the process whatsoever, and that is crystal clear, despite what others have said.
Well, the NUJ are coming out against you in Derry. It's an outrage that one of our members has been the target of slanderous attacks by representatives of the DUP. The DUP has attacked our member for allegedly allowing sectarian considerations to influence his recent reporting of how a Derry secondary school had received a grant.
Well, I'm not going to get into what the NUJ in the Northwest have said in relation to the particular journalist. What I have relayed to the Belfast Telegraph, and I have had my department raise this directly with the editorial team there about the inaccuracies of their reports around this, because they carried an article that said that this school had been put on hold by me. They carried an article that said that this project got the go-ahead against my wishes. Wholly inaccurate. And yet that is what was reported. And so I have asked for the Belfast Telegraph to review what they carried in terms of comments that were made. But there was also Twitter comments that were being made as well about backroom deals. There was no backroom deals. The inference in that is very clear. But not only is that wrong for me, they dragged a school into this. I didn't single out Lisneal. The Belfast Telegraph ran an article about one particular school. Political opponents then lifted that reporting and then used it in a political manner.
It is clear, Paul, that the questions around the funding of a pitch at Lisneal, you couldn't report that story and not say where it has happened. So the Belfast Telegraph have been doing a report on a school, and look, the Nolan Show does it and many other publications do it, where you focus the story on where it's happening. So I think we need to wait and let's see what the Belfast Telegraph continue.
So Stephen, here's the question that I have. Having raised one particular school, and an education committee that spent 90 minutes asking questions about one particular school, they now have a report, and I made it clear, not just through this EA report that was published yesterday, but in the Assembly, I highlighted other examples and comparators. And the question I have been raising, why the continued focus on one particular school?
But Paul. But
those questions can be applied to other schools projects.
Well, actually, and I know you need to go here, right? But actually, you know, if you look at some of the questions that we're asking because of the Belfast Telegraph reporting, to be fair to them, and they're a fine newspaper, as you know, they've done a very important job in Northern Ireland for many years. The claim was that this was a priority one project at Lisneal to get that pitch done because of health and safety. And it's in this education authority report that someone broke their leg. There was a serious break of a leg.
Correct.
And yet kids continued to play in that school for 5 years afterwards.
And the EA...
So how come it's so dangerous that it needs this upgrade and kids are playing on it every day for 5 years? Legitimate story, legitimate reporting, legitimate question.
And the report that EA have published makes clear that remedial work has been carried out over that intervening period so that they were able to continue to play sports on it. And I'm sure that will now be reported. I don't have any issue around these questions being asked around process, use of public funds. What I do have issues around is when articles are carried that say this project went ahead against the minister's wishes. That's wrong. It's inaccurate. When articles are covered that said, I put it on hold, that's wrong. That's inaccurate. I am absolutely up for journalists, and I make myself available more than most within the political world to be held to account. But what I do struggle with is inaccurate reporting, and that's what I'm challenging when it comes to it. But then others used it within the Assembly. So political opponents used this and created inferences around it, talked about a pet project. Nearly every single MLA from every political party come to me about particular projects in their constituency and say, Paul, could you come to this school? I want them to get the following. And they repeatedly ask and ask. They're doing their job. I have no problem with them doing it. But they then shouldn't frame something else for their own political advantage that somehow this was a pet project. It wasn't.
I think that there is a legitimate question to ask. If the Education Authority have no public criteria in place for how they prioritise a project, it's fair enough for the public to say, well, how do you come to the decision then? And where's the checks and balances within those decisions being made? And that's fair. Are you not even prepared to look at it?
No.
Are you prepared to look at how the decision is made at this stage? Well, are you doing it?
Yes.
You are?
Yes, we are. And what has been published today is also the outworkings of EA putting it into the public domain, because there's nothing to hide.
When you say you're looking at it, what do you mean?
Well, of course I asked questions in terms of this particular project and how minor work schemes operate. That is something that will be reviewed. I engaged with my own permanent secretary.
It will be reviewed. Are you calling for a review?
No, what I have sought is assurances that proper processes have been followed. That would be the normal thing to do. My accounting officer, who's the permanent secretary, would carry that out. He has engaged with the Education Authority chief executive in respect of this particular issue. That is part of the accountability mechanisms that my department has to ensure that there is oversight. But EA have now published a detailed document. It's available in the public domain. And I think it answers these questions in great detail. It speaks to the issues, highlights how the decision-making process was carried out. And I think that is the right approach that EA have taken. And I know they'll be going up to the committee and they will carry out their scrutiny work in respect of this project. All I say is, please don't use a school again in the way that it was used by my political opponents to try and score points against me. By all means, take me on. I've no issue with that. But to have used a school in that process, I think, is wrong. And I think we've seen the evidence of that and how the principal had to come out and publicly defend his position. I support all of our principals. I support every single sector in Northern Ireland, whether that's the Catholic maintained, Irish medium, controlled schools. They all need my support. But here is the real problem. When I put forward bids to the executive for well over £500 million of capital funding to support our schools, because they all need investment, and I only get just over £200 million. There's the real problem. We need significant investment.
That's precisely why we need to see and have a set of criteria as to how, when you've so short funding that you need, how are the EAs making the decisions? Who's been recently appointed to the EA in a senior position?
Yeah, and I'm glad you...
Who?
I'm glad you've brought that up.
Who?
Because here's one of the allegations that were made, that I handpicked the chief executive of EA. Wrong.
Who's the chief executive of the EA?
Well, it's Richard Pengelly. So here's the process for that, because facts matter.
I saw him at Mervyn's story. And look, I'm not suggesting that they're doing anything wrong, but you can see how the public's looking.
Yep.
At someone who's the husband of the Deputy First Minister, Emma Little Pengelly, that's Richard Pengelly. I am not questioning his integrity, but I'm talking about, you can see how the public is looking at Mervyn Storey, prominent DUP person on the Education Authority, which is simply why, to protect those people, surely you need a system transparent. Here's how we reach the decisions.
Yep. So I think now that that's been brought into the public domain, it's important that I set the record absolutely straight, which I have done on this. Because I did hear interviews over the Liz Neal issue where it was being thrown out around appointments to the EA. I did not go and find Richard Pengelly to be the chief executive. That was a process carried out by the head of the civil service. The head of the civil service, because I felt it needed to have a senior leader involved in taking the organisation forward, identified Richard Pengelly. That appointment was voted upon by the Education Board. I supported the appointment. I'm glad he's there because it's an organisation that he's turning round and is making sure that we have effective and efficient use of public funding. But the allegation that was made that I singled out and appointed is wrong, and it's unfair to him, and it's unfair to make the inferences that were associated with that. And Mervyn Storey came through a public appointments process. I didn't encourage him to apply. He applied like anybody else could apply. He was interviewed by a panel of which I was not on. And then there were candidates presented to me where I then made a ministerial appointment, and I explained why Mervyn Storey in that appointment was the most appropriate person to appoint. But he came through a public appointment process. Where has been the questioning from the Alliance Party for how Stephen Farrey was appointed to his role in the University of Ulster? Not an eyelid was batted around that process.
People have asked questions.
I haven't heard the Alliance Party. I've heard others like the DUP and my colleague Peter Martin asking questions about that. But I haven't heard the Alliance Party, who then throw out their inferences around appointments to the Education Authority. And it's also important to say that Liz Neal and the funding, that was reported to a committee of the Education Board. That committee is populated by political representatives, because the board has political representatives of other political parties. So they had more oversight of that project than I had as a minister. But I'm making sure that the processes are followed. So I think as people reflect on this, legitimate questions should be asked around the use of public funding. But it's important that we don't knock the public confidence in that process because there's political points being scored and a school was used to do that, and I think that's reprehensible.
I'm in trouble now because I promised you'd get out of here at 9:30, so I'm going to blame you for still talking. But Minister, thank you for coming in this morning. Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Linda and Money Moore, back to the school uniforms. Morning, Linda. Good morning.
Stephen, I just wanted to say, to back up what Minister was saying there, in my experience, my son is at high school, and I had an issue, which I spoke to you about 2 years ago, where the school would not permit him to wear plain navy shorts with his PE uniform. They wanted me to spend 3 times the amount on branded, no school logo on them, just a brand name, which I just don't think is acceptable. And as well, we have only one shop where we can buy our school uniform. Our blazer is about my son's blazer was about £90. I did inquire about neighbouring towns and neighbouring schools. Their blazers was £20-30 cheaper. So I think this really needs to happen.
Well, it's going in front of the Assembly today. The Minister laid out the timeline there. It could be in place by next year, Linda. The question still rests with me. Why have the school governors and the schools not voluntarily, and some of them have, but why have they not all as a collective voluntarily protected people like you from what's happening to you?
I really can't even answer that, because to me, it's common sense that a plain pair of navy shorts for a child that's doing PE in a closed off area in a school, I cannot understand why they wouldn't look at it and say, we need to help parents here. These children can wear plain PE shorts at £5 rather than spending 15 on the branded pair.
Thank you, Linda. Paul in County Fermanagh. Morning, Paul.
Morning, Stephen. It's a pity that you just didn't keep the Minister on there for a wee while longer, because I'd like to ask him.
Well, to be fair to him, I promised that he'd be gone by 9:30 because he's got a meeting in Stormont at 10 and he stayed another 12 minutes after that.
I'd just like to know where he's getting his quotations for school uniform, because I have two grandchildren there, one with a severe disability, and both grants for the child at special needs school and the child at secondary school is under £50. Now, the shoes for the child at the college is £80. So it doesn't even cover the shoes for either of the children. So as for branded uniforms, this is a complete nutter farce, because the employer I work for can supply me with a T-shirt which has the company logo and whatever rating you want on it for less than £3.50. So explain to me, this is where I'd like the minister to explain to me, how does it take up on £20 to £30 for a branded polo shirt? Well, when you can buy those of other companies outside of the school control for less than £10.
Well, he's saying...
And that's not fiction.
Well, he's saying that he's going to start putting... Ultimately, if there's a consultation and parents aren't happy, that he will put a cap on the cost of that branded gear or the number of branded items, Paul. That's the whole point of what he's saying.
Yeah, but again, he's not listening to the parents of Northern Ireland, because at the end of the day, £50, a grant of £50, as I say, will not even cover the cost of a pair of shoes. So what exactly, or what is he basing, what wage packet? Because let's face it, there is people without their own choice, unemployed in Northern Ireland, there is people on universal credit working on a low wage, and, you know, school uniforms is several hundred pounds. So what is he basing his information on, where he's providing a grant of less than £50, doesn't even cover the price of a pair of shoes? And then you have schools then who are, well, I don't know, I would guess they may be getting some commission from the companies that they're getting the uniforms for to
go into. And the minister is saying that will now, any commissions that any schools, I called them kickbacks earlier, any commissions that any schools are getting will have to be publicly disclosed in the future.
Yeah. Well, at the end of the day, parents should have the choice to go to whatever company they want to buy whatever brand of clothes that they actually want to buy. And you shouldn't be forced down a road where you're basically having to make a choice. In some cases, you're having to make a choice whether you put food on the table or you buy the uniform. And at the end of the day, it puts an onus on parents, because some children might be capable of going to certain schools, but the actual fact that they can't afford the uniform, like some of the PE kits is several hundred pounds on their own. Like, you know, we're living in 2025, a high rate of unemployment, poverty, we're just through the COVID crisis and everything else. Like, you know, where are they getting these figures out of? What wage packets are they basing it on? Is it their own? Because it's certainly not mine or my daughter's. So that's what I would like to ask.
So I'm slightly confused. Are you saying that you want more detail from the minister as to the actual quantum, the actual amount that he's going to cap? Is that what you're saying? Or because what he's saying is going to do is consistent with what you're saying should be done.
I would like to know, where does the minister base his quotation for the uniform grant that he allocates to parents? I would like to know, on what wage packet in Northern Ireland is he basing that on? Because it's not on the average family.
Okay, Paul, thank you. Pamela in Bangor. Morning, Pamela.
Good morning, Stephen. How are you?
Morning. Go ahead, Pamela. Thanks for calling. Yes.
I'm just saying that I'm almost 70. So if you go back when I was at school, what happened was you bought your blazer wherever you wanted, or your mommy did, and she sewed your badge onto the pocket on it. And the thing is, Stephen, it's all a money-making exercise. And people say, but, you know, you don't want this child feeling a bit out of it because they haven't the money to put it. It doesn't matter. You get your blazer from wherever you want and you buy the badge and your mommy sews it on or irons it on. And you do not need logos, even of your own school, on your PE kit, because you're either playing it in the sports hall, the gym, or you're playing it out in the playground or the field maybe beside it. Unless you're going into big league competition or something like that. And there again, the other thing is, then you just buy a smaller badge and you sew it on and save the parents.
So what
money.
Do you make of what the minister's doing? A cap now in the cost of school uniforms. The first, he says we're going further in Northern Ireland than anywhere else in the UK. Is that a good or a bad thing?
Well, is that meaning that a cap, because I had to get out of the car, does that mean that people can, or shops can only charge you so much? Is that what that means?
That means, Stephen, that what a school requires for a school uniform, that the cost of it, that the minister is now taking the power to say the cost of it cannot go over a certain amount. He's also giving himself the parts, whether he uses it or not. That if a school says, OK, you've got to have a branded pair of shorts, branded socks, you know, a branded top on your PE kits. The PE kit costs a lot of money, Pamela. He can say to a school, no, you're not doing that. You can go to a supermarket and get your PE kit.
Well, do you know what, Stephen? And why not? You know, the schools get enough money. And that other gentleman that was on is right. And he was saying, does the headmaster, he probably gets a backhander and gets a couple of PE kits himself or whatever. I'm not saying that's 100%, but I'm just, yeah, you know what I mean? So that's why he's pushing it to go to a certain shop. So that should be left open, Stephen. You should be able to go to Primark, Dunnes, anywhere, Marks and Spencer's, buy your blazer, buy your pinafore, buy, as that lady says, first of all, like a pair of blue shorts. And then because it has to have a logo, which isn't even the school's, but a logo, she has to pay three times as much. In this day and age, that is ridiculous.
Pamela, thank you. Good morning to you. We'll continue taking your calls on this morning as the Minister, Paul Given, has announced on the Nolan Show this morning legislation that will go through the Assembly to debate. Now he's putting it in front of them today over capping school uniform costs. Next, concerns have been voiced over anti-GAA posters that were erected in a County Antrim town. The posters appeared in the Neilsbrook area of Randallstown, and compared the GAA to the sporting wing of the IRA, adding it was not welcome here. Sinn Féin South Antrim MLA Declan Kearney described the incident as a sinister attempt by a small number of bigots to cause community division within the town. The posters were removed by the PSNI as part of the criminal investigation. The police say their placement is being treated as a sectarian hate crime. The commentator, Brendan Mulgrew, with us this morning. Your thoughts around this, Brendan? Good morning.
Good morning, Stephen. I think it's very sad that someone is so motivated by a desire to divide people and to stoke tension that, you know, these weren't even handmade posters. There was quite a bit of sophistication behind them. They were proper logos. They looked like they even had an element of design to them. I think it's very sad that someone is just of that mindset in 2025, Stephen. And the posters, it's absolutely correct that they were taken down by the police. That's to be commended. Because it's a very dangerous thing to put on a poster. You know, God knows what kind of person might see that message, take it to heart, believe that there's no other story involved with the GAA, and somehow act on that. And given the hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of young children and adults up and down the country who play and coach and go to watch GAA games, to have that sort of message put out there publicly is very dangerous. But ultimately, it makes you angry to read it, but I just think it's so sad that that's what someone's motivation is in life, to get up and put up that poster.
What does, Brendan, the GAA as an organisation, how do they feel about what the IRA did in the past?
Stephen, on the back of that poster being erected, I'll have a conversation with you any time about the history of the GAA and what it stands for, but I'm not going to have that conversation on the back of that poster being erected, because that just feeds into the sort of...
Well, here's the purpose.
The narrative that there's somehow some justification behind it.
There's no justification.
Of course there's not. I'm not having a conversation.
Okay, look,
and who am I? Corporate view does the GAA hold of the IRA? Does any sporting organisation have of any political issue or conflict? I don't think it's a relevant question.
Here's the purpose behind the question, Brendan, just to explain myself. So there's absolutely no justification whatsoever for that poster. There's no debate around it. The purpose for the question is, I'm wondering, does the GAA, should they be conveying more powerfully, more forcefully, more effectively what their current organisation stands for, rather than people talking about what the GAA did or didn't stand for 20 years ago? The IRA aren't active anymore. So the purpose of the question is, what's the present day approach from the GAA about cross community and reaching out to all?
Well, the last time the GAA was in the news for reasons other than what happens on the pitch on a Saturday or Sunday was when Derry City football team, soccer team, was generously facilitated the use of GAA Centre of Excellence headquarters in Owenbeg to prepare for their upcoming football season. It's GAA sharing pitches with rugby clubs and other sporting organisations in all parts of Northern Ireland.
Do you think this is... There you go. So that's it nearly validates the question in that. Is that out there? Does everybody know that? Is there a disconnect between what's currently happening and what people perceive?
No, I think it is out there. I think those things are out there, Stephen. But if someone, for whatever reason, chooses to not see them and chooses to try and drive wedges between communities here and to stoke tensions, then they'll do that and they'll choose to not see all of the clearly, obviously good things which the GAA and other sporting bodies are involved in. You know, every weekend, and particularly on Sundays, there are up and down Northern Ireland, up and down the country and beyond, there are tens of thousands of people giving their time and coaching kids, bringing them to see matches, going to see county teams. That's what they... And then we come into work on a Monday morning and chat ourselves about... Not about politics. It's about, geez, did you see that match? Did you see that foul? Did you see that score? And did that team did well? That's what it's about. It's about sport. It's about bringing people together. It's about a healthy pursuit. And posters growing up of the kind of which went up in Rattlestown, it's just a throwback to a different era. It belongs, it should be a different era. And it's very frustrating. It's very sad that people still have that mindset. Some people, a minority.
Brendan, thank you very much. Morning to you. Next, Nina, who contacted the Nolan Show. Morning, Nina.
Good morning.
Good morning. So we've been having a look at this for you. You did an online shop with who?
Asda.
Asda.
Yeah.
And you spent over £300 and they didn't deliver your shopping.
That's right, yeah. That was meant to be delivered on a Thursday and between 2 and 4 and at 4:30, still nothing. And I rung customer services and they told me there was a computer update of some sort. They weren't able to get my order, though they took £365.17 and still haven't got it back.
And so you contacted the Nolan Show?
So I did, yes. I was given advice from a good friend. He said, you can do the job.
So you've been out of pocket for how long now?
Yeah, well, this will be day 12. Mm-hmm.
So leaving you out of pocket, Asda leaving you out of pocket, £300 for 12 days.
Yes, and I have 2 dependents that live with me. So, I mean, it's been really, really hard, really hard. Been on the phone every single day. I've been in contact with the solicitor. I've been citizens advice. I could... Just, trying to get help of some sort to get this.
And you've been ringing them every day. Where's my money?
Every
what
day.
Have they been saying to you?
They said to me it'd be in within 24 to 40 hours, but that has never happened. Keep checking, and my solicitor advised me to just keep at them and keep at them 4 or 5 times a day. Same thing, they're reading a script, they're telling me the same thing, they're sorry, and nothing has ever... they even hung up on me. They wouldn't even let me speak to a supervisor. Whenever they did, that supervisor hung up on me. So it's ridiculous.
And you eventually came to us?
And eventually came to you, yes.
Are you ready?
Uh-huh.
Asda, we sincerely apologise for the time it's taken to receive your refund. Unfortunately, the process we have in place for refunds was not followed correctly on this occasion. The service you received fell short of the standards we aim for. We sincerely apologise to you and you will be getting a gesture of goodwill and your money back immediately.
Right. Oh, well, that's his first. Do you know this, Stephen? I honestly won't believe it until I see it because they've lied to me every day.
But here's what we're going to do, right?
Uh-huh. Yep.
You and I... are going to stay in touch with each other. Tomorrow morning, we'll be wanting to know if your money's in the bank. If it's not, we'll be back on the Asda immediately. And we will keep on broadcasting how they are
absolutely
treating you.
Absolutely brilliant.
All right?
That is brilliant, Stephen. Thank you so much.
Why didn't you come to us on day one?
Well, I didn't realise you could do such a thing. But there you go. As I said, a good friend helped me out. You helped him before, so... very grateful.
All right,
I am so grateful.
Don't be grateful. It's what you pay your license fee for. Listen, thank you for being in touch with us. Thank you for trusting us. Stay in touch with us until you get that money in your account. All right?
All right. Thank you so much, Stephen. I appreciate it. All right. Bye.
Good morning, everyone. A 12-year-old boy with Duchenne muscular dystrophy has said it's cruel that a new drug, which can help children with his condition, is not being made available here in Northern Ireland. Alfie Pentany from Newry was diagnosed with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, a devastating and progressive muscle-wasting disease in 2016. He was diagnosed at the age of 4. The new drug, Givinostat, is only available in England, and if made available, could give Alfie the ability to walk longer. I've been speaking to Alfie and his dad, James, about what a delay in getting the new drug means for them.
Alfie's 12 years old. He's my son. He's everything to me and his mother, Colleen. Unfortunately, Alfie is diagnosed with a disease called Duchenne muscular dystrophy. It only affects 1 in 3,500 boys worldwide. And it's a life-limiting terminal illness, and we're scared, really scared, of what might possibly happen. We just want this wee boy to have as a normal life as possible. And the reason we're on the show today and we're speaking to you is because of basically the Belfast Trust, the availability of a new drug, and I am not being able to take it on.
And we'll get into that in a second or two. How much does Alfie understand when you've talked to me there about life limiting and terminal illness? How much, Alfie, can I ask you?
Yeah.
How much do you understand when your dad talks about that?
I understand all of it.
So what does it mean when you hear...
My life expectancy's not as much as everybody else, and I could be in a wheelchair. But luckily, I'm not.
And you're just 12, Alfie?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you look so healthy to me. So it's confusing to me when I see you and your dad talking about you won't live as long as other people.
Yeah.
How do you handle that in your head, Alfie? I want to treat you today as with respect and not patronise you. So I want you to talk for yourself.
I mean, it's like, it's just confusing. So it is. To think that my life expectancy is shorter than other people's.
Yeah. And so you need a bit of help, don't you?
Yeah.
And what do you understand this drug would do for you, Alfie?
It would really help me because it would help me a lot, but there's other children that are going to stop walking before me. So it'd be important for them to get it as well.
And is that what your disease will do? It'll stop you walking?
Yeah.
And how soon do you think that might happen?
The doctors say it won't be, like, because I'm doing so well, it will take a while for that to happen.
Okay. My goodness, Jamie. You know, I'm talking to your son here, but we're both adults and it's just not fair, is it?
It's taken my family. It's taken a large toll on my family from after he was diagnosed 8 years ago. It's been the one thing that my family's been focused on. And to hear him talk about it, to hear him... Like, it's only the last couple of years that he started to Google this stuff and he's figured it out. You know, we tried to shield it, Alfie, as much as we could. But because we have him in the public eye, because we're trying to raise money, because we're trying to do every single thing we can to keep this boy walking and everything we can to just make sure his life's as normal as possible. It's absolutely terrifying. But we're Team Alfie, I'm my buddy.
Yeah.
So we're going to continue trying. So that's why things like these small steps, things that we can should be getting access to, they're so important.
So tell me about the situation and the battle you're having with the trust.
So basically there's an... Okay, so we all know that the NHS is basically on its knees anyway, right? But Belfast Trust is the guys that are over all the Duchenne boys in Northern Ireland, right? Well, there's around 50 of them. And there was something I quote in the paper saying 12, but it's not. It's around 50. There's another 12 boys plus Alfie that are eligible for this new drug. Now, this new drug is is only available to a small cohort of the population for Duchenne. You know, if you're not for under six and not for people who can't walk. So there's only a small, you know, percentage of them, I'd say maybe a third of them, that it can actually take availability of this drug. But the problem that we have encountered with the Belfast Trust, because we wanted this straight away. As soon as we knew that it was available and other trusts were taking it on, we says, right, let's go.
Other trusts are taking it on?
Yeah, well, there's the trust in England. You know, we're all under the same. So
yeah,
we know we were in Newcastle last week with his muscle specialist team. And we know that they're taking them on in Newcastle. We know they're taking it on in a couple of clinics in London. Quite a few clinics have confirmed that they've applied for it. You know, you have to fill in an application, whereas the Belfast Trust just agreed behind closed doors they didn't have the capacity and they weren't going to apply for it. And that's really my sticking point. Even they released a statement there in the newspaper yesterday to say that they weren't going to take it on, they didn't have the capacity. Who's going to tell the 13 kids in Northern Ireland that are available to this, and some of them mightn't be walking next year? Who's telling them that there's no capacity? We need some goodwill from this trust. We need somebody to shuffle the deck, move some things around, so we can treat him.
Alfie, I know you're only 12.
Yeah.
Only a little boy. But the trust are not giving you this drug. Would you be able to speak to them directly for yourself?
Yeah, I would.
What would you like to say to them?
It's cruel that they're not giving this drug to kids in Northern Ireland with this disability when most of them won't be walking next year. It's just horrible. I think we all have the right to have something that could help. So we do. But they just have not said they don't have the staff to do this. It's not good at all.
Like every day is time is muscle when it comes to Duchenne. Duchenne's a muscle wasting disease. So from when he was about 5 years old, his muscles haven't been able to repair themselves, so that's it. They just get weaker and weaker and weaker. And your lungs are a muscle and your heart's a muscle. And most of the boys actually die from heart failure. So every day that they're not giving us access to something, or they're not trying, every day that they are not trying, he's losing. He's losing a battle. And what are we here for? Me and Colin's here because we're advocates for him. We're standing up to make sure that his wee voice isn't getting ignored, and the other 12 boys and the other parents aren't getting ignored and just shunned away off and let go, you know, we can't do it and that's it. But this is the first thing that's come out in 20 years that could help my son. This is the first real, you know.
And they won't give it to you.
They're not going to say, I don't want to be throwing individual doctors or anything under any buses. They're telling us they do not have the capacity. They do not have the nurses to take the test. They don't have the neurologists to look after the boys while they're on this. Because the drug is actually free. It's getting given to the trust for free. So all they have to do is staff it and give it to the kids. Give me the kid. Give me it. We tried to get it years ago, this drug, to get on the trial and stuff. So, you know, once it's available, people who aren't bending over backwards obviously don't have a child that was as good a ticking clock beside them. Because if they did, the drug would be applied for.
What's the drug called?
It's called Javinostat.
And I can see the trust are telling us here that it has been approved by the MHRA.
Yep.
They say that NICE, that's the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, is currently developing recommendations for use of Javinostat within the NHS in England.
Yeah.
Currently developing, they say.
Well, it's they have a set of standards. What the trust have to do is wait for NICE to approve it. Now, because we've spoken to the trust, and they have told us once NICE approve it, they will have the capacity.
Well, how does that work?
Then here, isn't that a fantastic question, Stephen? How does that work? Like, they have to have that. Once that becomes a NHS standard of care, they have to find these hours that they don't have now, and they have to find the nurses, and they have to be able to take these 7 blood tests. And that's all it is, 7 blood tests over the course of 6 months. And they're simple platelet blood counts. They're just to check that the drug's not having an adverse effect on them.
The Trust are saying to us the drug is available for an early access program for eligible patients pending decisions about the wider access following NICE recommendations. Currently, Belfast Trust is not in a position to proceed under the EAP, as its implementation will need to be managed within defined and agreed protocols, and additional staffing resources will also be required to ensure the treatment can be provided safely. We recognise this will be very disappointing for families, and the Belfast Trust says sorry. Does that help you?
No.
Sorry, good enough?
No. When other kids could be in a wheelchair next year because the Belfast Trust weren't willing to apply for the drug.
You're fighting, Alfie, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're fighting for your rights.
Yeah.
Do you feel strong and confident to do that, or do you think the system will beat you?
No. I feel fine. I won't. There's just, I can't believe they're doing this over the, when it could help so many children, when it's just simple blood tests to do. Because it just, they just need a couple nurses to do blood tests. And they say they don't have the capacity.
I love them, the nurses or the doctors or whoever sent that statement out, you'd just stand in front of my son and tell him that they don't have the capacity. And if you're not, because if he loses the ability to walk in 1 year, he's not going to be entitled to it. You know, anybody who's not getting it and they're going to lose their ability in the next year while we wait on this NICE approval and stuff, that kid loses the ability to walk in the next 6 months, 8 months. And I personally know kids that aren't going to be walking this time next year.
How much time does Alfie have to get this drug before?
Well, Alfie's in an amazing position for a boy at 12 years old with Duchenne. We've been taking Alfie to America for the last few years to get stem cells to keep him going, but that's a completely different show, right? That's an hour long just to go into all that stuff. But Alfie was told that in a year's time he's still going to be walking. That's brilliant for him, but he's still going to decline in the year. He's still going to, you know, lose some abilities. He's still going to lose some abilities. So, but if he was getting this drug, it slows down the progression of the disease.
I understand. Alfie, are you walking completely fine at the moment?
Yeah. And I broke my hip in September. And that should have slowed me down. But in my physio and all, I'm doing really good. And it's like exactly the same as I was 2 or 3 years ago. So that's really good to hear.
You're such a small little boy with this big, big fight in you, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're brave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you've enough going on.
Mm-hmm.
And you need people to help you. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I do. Just need to be that little bit more helpful. So they do.
Have they sat down with you and explained to you why they're not helping you as much as you think they can?
No.
Why not?
Dunno. They just haven't really done that. They haven't talked about that. They've talked to me about my height before, but that's completely different. But, like, they just haven't talked.
Because I wonder this.
I can't help.
I wonder this, right? So we've got this kind of long, detailed written statement from the Trust, okay, to the BBC, to me. I think, having met you, that maybe you would like them to sit in front of you and explain to you what's going on. Would you like that?
Yeah, I would.
So would I, very much so.
You know, they're not sat in front of you either?
Well, there was no consultation with any of the parents. We got a phone call to... my wife received a phone call to say, a bit of bad news for you. And it wasn't from the doctor. It was from one of the other members of staff. And some bad news for you, Colin. You're not going to like this, but we're not going to apply for the drug because we don't have the capacity. The pharmacy doesn't have the capacity. And there's not enough nurses. And that was it. That was the end of the story when it came to Juvenistat in Northern Ireland.
We've got a devolved administration here. We've got a local health minister, Mike Nesbitt.
Oh, Mike, yeah. So we had... Mike doesn't really know what's going on. Straight up.
Why do you say that?
Why do I say that? Because we have some good MLAs that we work with. And that we know personally, Liz Kennens, I think she's the infrastructure minister now, but she would have grew up right beside us and be a good friend of colleagues and stuff. And we asked her just before Christmas about, you know, getting access to this drug. And Mike Nesbitt wrote an email on the 9th of January to say, this drug hasn't even been approved yet. But it was approved. I've got the email there to say that he didn't know something he should have known. And he sent out an email just, they can't get it. It's not for access.
So, Alfie, how are you going to fight going forward? You're telling your story here on the Nolan Show this morning. What do you want to see happen? What are you asking for?
They need to get the drug for the children. Because most of the children in Northern Ireland next year won't be walking.
And have you thought about that happening to you? And I'm sorry for that question.
Yeah. Sometimes. But you just have to get up and get on with it.
What have you thought about, Alfie?
I thought about going in a wheelchair, but if I do, I'll still be happy. Like, it's just another one of those things that happens. But if they can get this drug, that won't happen, I don't think.
Are you a happy boy?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm happy most of the time.
What do you like doing?
I like playing football.
Ah, who's your team?
Newcastle.
Oh, come on. Newcastle?
Yeah.
Oh, Man United. They're dreadful, aren't they?
Yeah.
I used to have a season ticket for Man United. I got rid of it. They were so boring. I got rid of it. What else do you like doing? Do you like school?
Yeah, I like it now. I didn't like it, but I like it now because I have friends in school.
Good, good. Una Farrell's listening to this, head of comms from the charity Duchenne UK. Hello, Una.
Hi, Stephen. Hi, Alfie. Hi, Jamie.
So, look, I'm understanding here through Alfie and Jamie about this drug, and it's going to be rolled out in England or started to be used in England next week.
We know. So it was approved by the MHRA at the end of the year, and it has been available through this early access program for almost 6 months now. And so all the eligible trusts in the UK have been able to avail of this and provide it to their patients with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. But none have so far, but we know that there is at least two trusts that are moving forward with this, and that several children have had the tests and the blood tests in preparation for being dosed with Juvenistat. So if the NHS, we all know the NHS is struggling massively with resources, but it's just hard to understand with a disease that's so cruel and that's progressive and time is muscle, why children cannot be given access to it now.
And to refer to the Belfast Trust then, there are only two trusts across the water who are going to be giving this anytime soon to children. Is that what you're saying?
That's two out of 24 that are eligible that have neuromuscular specialists. We still think, we understand that resources are a huge issue, but it's been known for several years that this drug was on its way, and there's no cure for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And this, finally there's a treatment that the data suggests it can slow down the progression.
How much does it slow it down by?
It can delay. I can't say it's not exact, but it can mean that you're walking for 2 years longer than you would be. But it also, it's not just about walking. It's also because it's Duchenne muscular dystrophy affects every muscle in the body. So it's also upper body mobility. So the usual progression of the disease is that you go into a wheelchair and need to use that part time and then permanently. But then it's also your ability to use your arms. So, and that is so important for independence and for being able to just live the life you want. So for being able to brush your teeth, or even as the disease progresses, if you have an itchy nose, just being able to itch your nose, that's how serious it is. You know, it eventually affects all the muscles in the body, including the heart and lungs. So time is muscle. So for Belfast Health and Care Social Trust to say that it's disappointing for families, that's not this. It's absolutely devastating to know that there is this treatment. It's been made available to the NHS. And
but
yes,
if they don't have the staff and they don't have the resources, what do they do?
There must be ways that this can be delivered. Look what happened during the pandemic, the way we quickly reorganized how we delivered healthcare. We just, particularly because it was known that this treatment was on its way. And Duchenne muscular dystrophy, it's a rare disease, so it is only a small number of people who will need it. And it's such a cruel disease, and it's time as muscle. This could make the difference. Waiting for this for a year can mean the difference between walking or not walking for many children.
Una, thank you. Jimmy, it's been nice to meet you today, but Alfie, you've made my day meeting you, because I just see, a little boy who, you're so polite. You're so, so polite.
Yeah.
And yet, you're facing a lot, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am. But it's just one of them things you have to deal with.
It's amazing, Jamie, isn't it?
Yeah, that's why we do what we do, Stephen. That's why we do what we do. Frame here. I'm his advocate. Whatever it takes.
I want to leave the last words to you. 12-year-old Alfie, speak to the Health Minister, Mike Nesbitt.
It's horrible that you can't get a drug that not even 13 children, because the rest in Northern Ireland can't walk and they're getting weaker because just all other boys are getting way weaker. It's not fair. It's disgraceful. It's horrible. Like, it just why would you do that? Like, just because some of them just aren't going to be walking in 6 months.
Well, look, I know that Mike Nesbitt, as a minister, he's got so much demands on. That big department, which is the health service. But I also know that he was watching a documentary on the BBC and reacted to it, and it moved him. So hopefully he will hear your voice, Alfie.
Yeah.
And I don't know what he can or can't do, but hopefully he will at least hear your story. All right? Thank you so much, young man. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Jimmy.
All right, thank you, Stephen.
Well, the Department of Health have issued the following statement. They've said the Minister fully understands that patients and families want to access the best available health service treatments and drugs. MHRA, as the UK's medicines regulator, authorises medicines for the UK market that have met regulatory standards of safety, quality and efficacy. A decision to license a medicine does not automatically mean that the medicine will be made available on the health service. Routine health service access to Javinostat will depend on NICE guidance. The department maintains a formal link with NICE. In practice, this means that treatments that have been recommended by NICE for routine use
in the NHS in England are also routinely available in Northern Ireland. NICE are developing guidance on the clinical and cost effectiveness of Javinostat for the treatment of DMD in people 6 years and over, with a committee meeting scheduled for May 2025. That's the statement from the Department of Health. A letter, in terms of the letter that was distributed to the young man's father, a letter to an elected representative, says the department, prepared for the minister and sent on the 2nd of January of this year, should have been updated to reflect MHRA's announcement on the 20th of December that Javinostat was being licensed. We apologise for this oversight. Subsequent correspondence with the same elected representative included the updated information, which reflects the current licensing and access position. Look, that's all the statements. There's a little 12-year-old boy that just wants answers and wants help. Minister Given, who is in the studio today, saying he's challenging some of the reporting. The Belfast Telegraph have been in touch with the Nolan Show, or we asked them, and they said the Belfast Telegraph stands over our reporting of this story and the subsequent coverage by other shows. This is a matter of legitimate public interest. Okay, that's it for today. We'll see you all tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Have a good Tuesday. Bye-bye.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.